Our political commentators today, we welcome Sue Bradford and Liam Hare. Kia ora korua, welcome.
Kia ora, Catherine. Good to be back.
Sue is with us. She's a community-based activist and a former Green MP. Liam is a Palmerston North lawyer, political commentator and a member of the National Party. Let's begin. I know obviously things got quite dramatic last week. Hi, Liam. Great to have you with us. Things got a bit dramatic last week. And we'll get into more of that in a moment and the significance of it. But let's stay with some of the substance, first of all, particularly around New Zealand, the New Zealand government's position on considering joining Pillar 2 of AUKUS. This speech was deemed necessary, Sue, by the foreign minister. There was a sense that things were moving pretty quickly. Did Winston Peters' speech itself clarify anything about where the government is heading with AUKUS?
Not from my reading of it. He seems to be hedging all bets, despite what may be his own personal position and his anger at having a protest to disrupt the meeting. Because when you look at the speech, he's really saying, oh, we need to take a lot of care. We need to have a more detailed understanding of what Pillar 2 means. He's talking about the long timelines. But then you have to look at the other side and his problems with Carr. So it feels like he's got a position and that he's likely to be wanting to charge into it, but he's also being pretty careful, at least in that speech, which Liam, may well have been written by others.
Well, I mean, most speeches are, to be honest. Are you alluding to others who aren't officials in working for the New Zealand government?
No.
All right, that's good. That's good to know. Liam, is it a case that the foreign minister may have intentionally or otherwise made things sound like they were further along than they were when he was in the US and has had to walk things back a bit? That is another interpretation.
Well, I think that, you know, Peters has made wants to make absolutely clear the direction of travel, right? And in doing that, you know, he has created the risk. Or the perception or misperception of things being more advanced than they are. Now, whether or not that was on accident, whether or not that's on purpose, we're just not given to know those things. But all we can do is assess what has happened, which is that, you know, it's abundantly clear where Peters would like New Zealand to go, but he's recontextualized the timeline to make clear that it's going to be a while away, right? And so, I think the purpose that's served by how he's conducted himself is probably to make clear where he thinks New Zealand needs to head, and is now trying to add in more details to clarify to diffuse the issue a little bit by being a bit more circumspect. So beyond that, it's very, very hard to know anything.
So your position on this, that the idea of a bipartisanship, although it doesn't always exist at the outset of these things, right, but the idea of a bipartisanship on major matters of foreign policy, where are the likes of Labour, where are the likes of the Greens, on this direction of travel that still has a long way to go? At what point what position do they need to take with respect to this?
Well, my understanding is Labor, while having supported these negotiations for Pillar 2 in the past, is moving away from that position. And the Greens, as far as I know, do not support it, which is cool from my point of view. I do think that it's best if we have bipartisanship in foreign policy, and I'm hoping in this case of Pillar 2 of AUKUS that bipartisanship leads us to move very clearly into a 100% neutral position so that we don't become part of helping to create war rather than peace in the Pacific. We've got, since the nuclear free legislation of the 1980s, We've been held in quite high regard around the world, and we are facing real dangers in our region and all over the world. And the more of a peaceful role we can play, the better for everyone in this country, from whatever sector or political background we come from.
Liam, the challenge that those who say you need to consider this put forward is the way contemporary conflict may evolve, although goodness knows, looking around the world, it is painfully on the ground and brutal at the moment where we are seeing it. But this perception that New Zealand needs some of the tools that may be part of, or potentially arguably part of, avoiding conflicts going forward. Has that case been articulated again by the government?
Well, it was articulated by Winston Peters, and he made the very good point that, you know, while some people might like us to be a non-aligned country or a neutral country, we're not. We have a military alliance with Australia. And if Australia's dragged into a conflict, we're going to be dragged into a conflict too. Now, you might say that we should become non-aligned and neutral, but we're not at the moment. And if we're going to be in that alliance, you know, we need to be a contributor to it, and we need to get the best out of it that we can as well. Now, the danger that I perceive it in terms of taking a non-partisan approach to foreign policy is when you get the scenario, the Greens will always take a very principled stand, and that's the Greens, and they've got a valid view and they argue for it hard. The danger is that the parties like National and Labour say one thing in opposition and do another thing in government. And so, you know, if Labour come in after the next election and they decide to rebrand it as the Comprehensive and Progressive AUKUS Pillar 2 and sign it, that would be another example of governments taking a sort of populist approach in opposition and then switching. And it's not just Labour. Labour did it with the TPP, but National's done it too. National did it with the UN Migration Compact. And so I think, you know, that the discipline that's required from the larger parties in terms of maintaining a non-partisan foreign policy is to not scratch ideological itches when they think they might get a temporary domestic political gain from it.
That is an interesting perspective on it all. Now, we'll just touch on what happened. Either of you can explain. The Foreign Minister getting quite strong in his language in an interview on Morning Report. Well, quite specific, too specific, in his comments about a former Foreign Minister, Bob Carr. It's quite an extraordinary situation, isn't it, to have two such senior veteran figures in politics, one of them a current Foreign Minister, now in a legal spat. Sue, what do you make of it all?
Well, I think that having Winston Peters as this country's Foreign Minister was always going to be a big risk for Christopher Luxon and National, even though they felt they didn't have a choice. Because I don't think any of us can ever be sure of what Mr. Peters will come out with in any given situation.
He's done it before, though. You know, he's played it in that role in governments before without particular drama.
Oh, absolutely. Well, he tries. You can see him really trying on his diplomatic missions. But in this case, it's really out of hand to put himself into this position he's in of being sued by Mr. Carr. And he's created a big liability for the taxpayer. It's not Mr. Peters who's going to have to pay any bills. Plus, it is a reminder of how undiplomatic Winston Peters is in domestic politics. And one can't help but think about, as with the leadership, the presidential candidates in America, that Mr. Peters too is becoming an older person. And sometimes things just don't quite hold together in the same way as when you're younger. But it's in Mr. Peters' nature not to be diplomatic, and I think there's further risks possible down the track.
All right. I was going to say, so isn't this an example of Mr. Peters reverting to his more youthful self
a little bit?
But look, I think everything you said is very valid. I'll just point out a couple of things. So in the first place, you know, this is not how we would conventionally expect a foreign minister to conduct himself. But on the other hand, you know, Mr. Carr is retired. He's out of elected politics. And he's not a representative of Australia, and his views contradict the bipartisan consensus of Australian politics too. So it's not quite the diplomatic problem that I think some people are making out.
Yeah. But also, you know, Mr. Peters' point is, if you're going to wade, if you're going to come across to another country and wade into our foreign policy like this, kind of fair game. Mr. Carr is all of 3 years. Actually, I'm gonna have to check the relative ages now. Relative ages and era of the protagonists here. Do we really need to see legal threats here, Liam? Or again, we're not going to repeat the comment under consideration. Is it a fair response?
I would be surprised if like you don't rule it out, I suppose. But bringing a legal challenge, actually bringing a legal claim, filing defamation suit, would be a big call, right? And for a couple of reasons, and one is that there is a space to make honest comment, fair comment about matters of public importance, and to have some protection from that under defamation laws. But also, I think Sue made a really good point, which is that any defamation claim that's brought against Mr. Peters is going to have the defence bankrolled by the New Zealand state. Whereas, if Mr. Carr is just a private citizen, without millions of dollars to, fight a defamation case all the way to the Supreme Court, that would be a very, very big call on his part. And so I while we're at this age of threats and blustering, I would be surprised a little bit if anything really came of it in terms of a court
Well,
case.
sometimes the threat is enough to restore one's sense of outrage, isn't it? Okay. As the unemployment rate creeps up and youth are hardest hit, and in the context of a recession, the Remuneration Authority comes out with, admittedly, the first move on MPs' pay or that it's allowed to make in quite some years. It was kind of a week of news you wish you weren't having to deal with for political leaders all over the place, wasn't it, Liam? What about this one?
Yeah. Well, they've made a rod for their own back, right, by freezing their pay for 6 years. So they set up the Remuneration Authority. The idea is that this is not a political decision anymore. Politicians, in theory, can't be blamed for putting their own pay up because it's all happening at arm's length. But it's a bit like boiling the frog. If you turn up the temperature gradually, the frog doesn't notice. But if you keep it at the same temperature, then jump it up a whole lot in a short amount of time, the frog jumps out, and that's what's happened, right? So they've made a rod for their own back. Because they've taken the populist approach of wanting to limit their own pay, and now there's a catch up. And I think the only way that you could they could ever not have this dilemma would be to have some sort of regime where their pay is indexed to some sort of labor costs index, or a something to do with tied to inflation or
Well,
something
that
like
might be a
that.
reality check for them, Sue.
Yes. I can remember when I was an MP, like the embarrassment of being approached on the bridge about the latest pay rise when one is fighting for low-paid workers and beneficiaries and one's.
Oh, I think Sue's just
And
dropped. Oh, no,
it is
she's
an
back.
acute
Yep.
embarrassment every time, but it was very embarrassing as an MP, and can see MPs now being highly embarrassed by it. But as Liam says, once they'd made that decision in 2018 to do a pay freeze for MPs, there's this massive catch-up. So all the MPs have to take it. You don't have a choice about turning down the Remuneration Authority decision unless you legislate. So they're now very stuck with what they've done, and even Chloe Swarbrick seems to be accepting it. So without putting into place another pay freeze, I think the main options they've got is actually to seriously consider completely revising the processes which guide the Remuneration Authority, and/or possibly talking what doing what Liam mentioned, which is indexing the pay rises to something like the median wage.
Okay, let's have a look at the bad polls that the week began with, and a lot of reaction to the TVNZ coverage of its first poll, the first of a clutch of polls, the Varian poll. And look, you could argue whether this early in the term it was overshooting some of the commentary. You could also argue whether it was protesting a bit too much on behalf of the government when subsequent polls came out telling them a similar story, which is, okay, we're not going to talk about who's in and out of government right now, but for this early in a government's term, this is a bad brace of polls, Sue, and it must be sobering to say the least.
Yes, you can see it on their faces. It's unusual for such a downward swing to happen so soon after an election, only 6 months since the coalition was formed. And it feels to me, and it has been over the last couple of months, that more and more people who su possibly supported the right in the election are having buyer's remorse, including around things like the focus on the property investors' tax over supporting health and education, disability support and housing. And now the assault which we see with the fast pass track bill, where even quite people from across parties really support maintaining our beautiful environment, keeping our natural resources, keeping our marine environment. And there's such an assault on that implied in the fast track bill that I actually wonder how much impact that alone is having at the moment on the vote for the three governing parties.
Well, also farmers opposed to it. They're worried about implications potentially for them down the track, and particularly were there to be a change of government. So there's also it's the economy, stupid, as you know, Bill Clinton's aide stated back in the 90s, and people are doing it tough and feeling negative and experiencing the negative impacts of a recession, Liam. Can the government just say, okay, that's the main driver?
Well, it is. I mean, that's the reality. I mean, if there are many controversial political issues in New Zealand right now, but it's hard for those of us who are partisan to separate them out from the things that are driving the bad polls. And I agree that they're bad polls. I think a lot of the reaction to TVNZ's coverage was shooting the messenger, really. But, you know, if the same poll showed that there was even support and opposition to the fast-track bill, the same poll showed a pretty clear majority in favour of the government's cuts to the public sector, even. But what really does drive voter sentiment, and I can tell you as someone who has a small business, is that the economy just really sucks. It's terrible at the moment. You know, no one has any money. Inflation's stubborn. People struggle to pay their bills, and every time they go to the grocery store, it's worse. Every time you get your insurance bill, it's worse. And incumbents suffer from that. The worsening economy was the reason why the Labor government had such a short life. Inflation was what doomed their government. And unless this government gets on top of it or makes meaningful progress within the next year or so, it's going to struggle to be re-elected.
Well, Sue, let's look at the readiness of the opposition for that opportunity that may come, because this recession and indeed interest rates around the world is prolonged. And has the risk of staying prolonged. The government's books, and the deficit, the odds of getting back, the finance minister conceding now, even the earlier target to be back in the black, is looking optimistic, to put it mildly. But how much will this come down to the readiness of Labour Green, Te Pāti Māori, as the opposition parties, to look like a government in waiting? Do you want to comment first on Labour's situation? It seems to be just holding it together, keeping it low key, and avoiding making mistakes at the moment. Sue, but will that be enough?
Oh, I don't think so. I think that Labour really has to get its act together a lot more quickly on coming up with inspiring, hopeful, exciting, and substantive new policies on things like income redistribution, housing, taxes, and on things to do with climate justice and the environment as well. Like, they've got to get serious instead of just wobbling along, barely holding it together with a visible leadership that I don't think is widely supported and trusted in the wider community, whether it's those people themselves or there's a perception, what do they stand for? There's an opportunity here for Labour and the Greens and Te Pāti Māori. This government could very quickly appear to be dead in the water. When would it have lost its mandate? But unless you have strong opposition parties ready to pick that up, it's going to flop on both sides. So Labour really has to get moving.
Does it have an identity crisis also, Liam, in terms of where do you move? Do you move to the centre, where that rich, and centre I know is a very loose term, but that's kind of rich voter vein is potentially, or are you inclined to go further left, to go to bigger, bolder reform on the likes of taxes? This is going to be Labour's great internal challenge, isn't it?
Well, I hope that they take Sue's advice, and the reason is because I think they're doing everything completely correctly at the moment, to be honest. You know, I know it's a cliche, but, you know, you don't win from opposition. You take opportunities from the government losing favour, and a small target's best for that. And so, you know, the Labour Party has done a really good job. Everyone who I know in the National Party has been waiting for Labour to have a internal discussion, to talk a lot about itself, to try to talk about what it stands for, to talk about its identity, all those things that actually turn off voters who are just worried about the price of groceries, rent, and insurance. And so, you know, it's to me, I think that any time the political party is mostly talking about itself, mostly talking about where it stands, that party is alienating to swing voters. It might do very well with its with sort of more ideological supporters, but I think at the moment Labor's doing an admirable job. They have avoided the collapse, and in fact, the fact that the Labor Party isn't tearing itself apart with infighting and navel gazing is one of the reasons why the government's doing a bit tough at the
Yeah,
moment.
it's still got the harder yards ahead, though, is that time. And you do have time. You have
You've
right
got two
through
and a half
potentially
years.
to the third year of a government to actually
Yeah,
articulate what you would do
if it
differently.
lasts that long.
Okay.
If
Now,
the
the
government lasts that
Greens,
long.
so we'll come back to this in a moment. The Julian Genta, look, I think most people who've watched Parliament at all, let alone a lot, over the years were pretty gobsmacked by what happened in the House the other night. And some incidents have been coming out subsequently. All of them, it seems, in the context of a very heated debate in Wellington, the issue of cycleways versus businesses. But nonetheless, some of this reporting will be causing angst and challenge within the Greens. How do they handle the Sue, and how does she handle it, indeed?
Well, on the face of it, it was a really shocking incident, and one can only imagine what might have been going through Julian Genta's mind at the time. The Greens traditionally have been very keen on their MPs being mature and respectful and ethical in the House. It was certainly always drummed into us, so I was really shocked because, I mean, Julian Genta isn't a new MP, she's been there for a while and is well aware of the House conventions and Green Party policy around this. So I worry about what's happening with her and for her. And it's quite alarming how these incidents trigger other allegations. So I'm sure it's a tough time for the leadership of the Greens as well as for Julian Genta, coming on top of a string of other mishaps with MPs since the election. The Darlene Hough case is still trickling along without any outcome. It's just taken an extraordinary time. And I do think that the Green Party seriously has to look both at how well they support their current MPs, but also what they might do to change their selection processes and how much they listen to local Greens and local communities when they carry out candidate selection, because this is not good. Now, this is not so much in relation to Julian Genta, but with certain other MPs, yes.
Liam?
Yeah, I think it's a really fair assessment of things. Julian Genta is in a terrible position now, and one of her own making to an extent, because I can't in a million years imagine Sue Bradford ever crossing the floor of Parliament to get in someone's face like that. And that's certainly not been how the Greens have presented themselves in the past. But now that that's happened, everyone who's ever had got an axe to grind against Julian Genta sort of has his license to come up and bring it up, years later, and in ways that are essentially unprovable, but in a way that every time it happens, it sort of chips away at the benefit of the doubt for her, and so it will be really tough for her to come back from this. I mean, she had a big success last year, winning the Rongotai electorate, but on the other hand, she is a very long-serving MP. She's been passed over for the leadership a couple of times. And I just wonder if she will, decide enough is enough at the next election and say, I've done my time, I'm at the end of my rope, and no more. But I don't think she'll, cause complications for the Greens for her to retire straight away. But what you might see is, I think, a winding back of her activity, and she might not stand again.
Let's see. Thank you both. Liam here, Sue Bradford.